It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent.
Wisconsin polka and baseball fans recognize this song. It's the Beer Barrel Polka, which plays during the seventh inning stretch at Brewers games.
The version we're listening to was recorded by a local musician who created an entire album of original country, bluegrass, and rockabilly songs dedicated to his favorite baseball team.
Nate Gibson is an archivist and musician based in Madison and performs with Nate Gibson and the Stardazers. His brand new album is called Fear the Beer, a musical salute to the Milwaukee Brewers.
The album came out Friday. He joined us in the studio last week as he was gearing up for the big release.
Okay, a lot of Brewers fans excited about this season with good reason. You're taking it a step further here, recording not a song or two songs, an album dedicated to the Brewers. What sparked this for you?
That's right. I'm familiar with a lot of those songs about the Brewers from the 80s. There was Brewer Fever or Turning Up the Heat, Brewers Have It All, Brewers All the Way. And I thought there hasn't been a lot of songs recently about the Brewers. And I'm a country musician, and I host a classic country music show. And I started looking into all the connections between country music and the Brewers, and I got a little carried away. But, you know, Charlie Pride was an honorary Brewer, and I found these postcards of him at Brewer spring training in 71, 72, and 73, and I was kind of floored by that. And then I just started making all these connections. Hank the dog was the Brewers mascot for a while, and I thought, well, Hank is a popular country name. I can certainly work with that. And the AAA team is in Nashville, and so there's all these connections.
I think there's a country music connection there,
right? There's a country music connection to Nashville. And I just was kind of floored by a lot of the country connection. They have country night all the time. We were just at the game the other day. When Brandon Woodruff comes in, he's coming into, Luke Bryan. Cody Jinks is Koenig's walk-up. Johnny Cash is used for Andrew Vaughn's walk-up. And I started thinking, wow, there's a lot of country here. What if I wrote a country song about the Brewers? And after I wrote one, I thought I could probably do two. And then I told my wife that night, I bet I could do a whole album. And she challenged me to do it.
And you are on the clock here, right? They got the pitch clock now. Well, you're trying to get this done in a timely fashion for a Brewers playoff run. When did you start? What is the time pressure here?
Oh, yeah, that was about a month ago that I said that. And I said, what if I wrote an entire album and I recorded them and we mixed them and we got it out before the playoffs started? And she definitely thought that was a ludicrous idea.
Yeah. For people not familiar with how music recording generally works, 1 month for an album is not generally how it's done.
Right, at least from writing. And every other project, this is maybe my ninth album that I've made. I've gone to studios and I've had full bands, and you rehearse for a long time and you make sure it's ready and you spend a long time mixing. This is a bedroom project that I just, because the only person I met who said, "That's a good idea." The only one was my nephew, Ethan, who fronts a heavy metal band and is an amazing engineer, live audio engineer. And he said, "We could probably do that and I could help you." And I just thought, well, if Ethan's going to help me, I love this kid. And I've been making records since before he was born, but he knows all how to make a record quickly, and he's brilliant. So I said, let's do this.
And you brought in some other Wisconsin musicians, I'm assuming Brewers fans, or not anti-Brewers, if they're on the album.
That's right.
What was it like putting together a team on short notice?
It was very difficult. But the reason I make music is to be involved in a project with people I care about and really admire and appreciate. That's always been the goal of making music. So to get Art Stevenson playing harmonica, he co-hosts Back to the Country with me, and he's singing harmony vocals with me. And to get Andrew Harrison, who plays in my band, the Stardazers, with me, to get him to play guitar on it was a thrill. Randy Finley is an amazing fiddle player. This is the first time we got to work together. But what it required of every one of those individuals is a last-minute, "Hey, I'm on a tight timeline. I have to get this done by tomorrow. Can you record parts today at 4 o'clock? Can you come over and do this?" And everybody said yes.
You know, one curse sometimes of recording music is people overthink it. You probably beat that curse on this one.
I definitely didn't overthink it. It's a 100% rush job. But the thing that I think this project has that those 80s Brewers songs didn't have, though they inspired me, they seemed somewhat generic. Come see what's brewing. Come see what the good times are. You could replace the word brewer and put Pac-Man. It could be Pac-Man fever. It could be Campbell's soup fever. It's very generic. But I think my songs, I really like them, and I think they're very unique to not just the Brewers and this season, but their country music connections.
Well, and like a lot of country music, it's a storytelling genre, a lot of country and the related genres. And each of your songs, except maybe one, and I'll get to that in just a minute,
okay.
Each one is a story. Like you've got Get Up, Get Up, Get Out of Here. Well, who's that about? Bob Uecker, right?
That's right.
Each of them, and you mentioned Charlie Pride. Yeah. That song, you've got a song telling the story. These are storytelling songs.
That's right. Yeah, I have. I started thinking about most of these songs start with in 1897 or in 1966. It definitely has like a narrative historical feel to wanting to tell a story of how these connections happened and why.
All right. Now, I said there's one exception that's maybe you always need that like anthem song, right, for your team. And the title track, Fear the Beer, I think fits the bill. Here's a listen.
Fear the beer, there ain't a slogan truer.
All right, tell us a little bit about your title track there.
When I started writing songs, and it starts with, for me, my process is I get to open a Google Doc, and I just start typing ideas of songs, and it usually starts with song titles. Then I start fleshing that out a little bit with what would verse one be, what would verse two be about, what verse three be about. And as I started writing songs, the list, I started needing words that rhyme with brewers. And so at the bottom of this, what ended up being probably like a 60, 70 page list, word doc, I started just writing words that rhyme with brewers. And I wrote a whole bunch of them. And then I looked at the bottom of that list and I thought, well, now I've got like 60 words that rhyme with brewers. I didn't think there were that many. What if I just use a song where every single line rhymes with brewers? And that's just how Fear the Beer came about.
Now, I mentioned the Bob Uecker song, and I imagine as you started to think, okay, what are my songs going to be about, you got to have a Bob Uecker song.
His voice on the radio, just a bit outside, inning after inning, his calls brought out the smile. Get up, get up, get out of here, the legend lives on. Too far away. Uecker's still with us each and every game, each and every play.
Bob Uecker was the reason I became a Brewers fan.
Wow.
I grew up in St. Louis, was a huge Cardinals fan until I moved to Kansas. And that coincided with April 1st of 1987 when the Cardinals traded Andy Van Slyke to the Pirates. So now I moved away from the stadium and I lost my favorite baseball player to Pittsburgh. I just became a Pirates fan. And then I moved to Boston. And Boston was when the 2004 World Series was coming about and breaking of the curse. And I got really excited about the Red Sox. So I went to all those games. Huge Red Sox fan. And then when I moved here, which was 8.5 years ago, to Wisconsin, I thought, well, I love the Red Sox, but Bob Uecker is so great, and I could really just listen to him tell stories all the time. So I started just listening at night to the Brewers games and loving them, and eventually started going to Brewers games, and he won me over. So I wanted to write a tribute for him, but the idea was to have a clip from him in 1982 ALCS call. It's my favorite of his. It wasn't his favorite, but my favorite, because he's basically in tears when they go to the World Series for the first time. He's screaming about the fans running on the field. It's pandemonium. It's pandemonium. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And I cut up that clip to fit perfectly in the solo. And I was going to have that. And I asked the Brewers and I talked to their legal and they said, we can't give you permission to do that. And I'm devastated because the song was for that purpose. But my wife convinced me the song holds up on its own, and I still want to send it to Bob Uecker's family, and I still just want to pay my tributes to Bob Uecker.
We're talking to the musician Nate Gibson about his new album celebrating the Brewers' hot season. It's called Fear the Beer, a musical salute to the Milwaukee Brewers. Well, you've got another person honored in this, so the song is This Bud's for You. It's not about Bud the Beer. Let's give a listen.
Well, Milwaukee's been home to lots who brew their own beer, but I think we owe a song to Bud because he brought the Brewers here.
So that Bud is Bud Selig, of course, who brought the Brewers to Milwaukee. Famous around the country. I mean, he ended up being the Major League Baseball commissioner. But you're focused on his, of course, his Milwaukee connection there.
That's right. I just thought it would be hilarious. It's not really needling Milwaukee fans, but it's funny for those who would just hear song about Schlitz and Blatz and Pabst and Miller High Life and all these brews, and then have the song called This Bud's for You. It just seems so... not right. but yeah, it's a tribute to Bud Selig and all the great stuff he did for Milwaukee.
Now, you tackle the one of the seventh inning stretch songs, not Take Me Out to the Ball Game, though.
Well, I love that the Brewers don't do that. Everybody does Take Me Out to the Ball Game except for Milwaukee Brewers. They do a roll out the beer barrel polka. Mm-hmm. And I love that they do it. It's so Wisconsin and it's so perfect. So yeah, we had to do that.
Now, sometimes when there is Brewer fever or whatever sports team fever, some of these songs catch on. Now, you're just releasing these now. Are you hoping that people are going to take these songs and run with them? And are you talking to the Brewers like, hey, guys, I got all these songs if you want to play them at this, you know, during a game?
You know, and I read about Terry Cashman. Terry Cashman wrote the song Talkin' Baseball. It's probably the most famous baseball mm-hmm. song out there. And he wrote that song for Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. But it was so popular that... he ended up re-recording it for every single Major League Baseball team. And then he recorded albums of, and it's the same backing track on every one, but he recorded something like 40 different versions of that same song, just with different players' names. And his whole intent in doing that was to meet the players. And so that he actually did. He got to sing that song at the Cooperstown Hall of Fame. So I don't actually have any grand expectations, but if this means that the Brewers heard this and they liked it, and I got to perform at a Brewers game, in the lobby, in the bar somewhere. I don't know. Just somehow could be part of the Brewers experience. That would be a thrill for me. And if people listen to this record and they like it, I think it's an upgrade from Turning Up the Heat. I think it's a...
it is. I mean, I know the song. It is an upgrade, definitely, yeah. Having listened to yours versus that. Live performances, whether or not you get to play, you know, at a game, do you think you might take this to shows here in Wisconsin and bring in a band and actually perform these guys live?
Yeah, I have to talk about it. I do have a band, Nate Gibson and the Stardazers. We recently played Stoughton Opera House and the Hamill Center and in Baraboo at the Al Ringling Theater. We've done some fun shows, but we have a thing. We do a lot of Star Day songs. We do a lot of originals, mm-hmm. a lot of honky tonk and Western swing. We'd have to get together and work for a while to put together a whole Brewer show. But solo performances and maybe with a couple friends, a smaller thing, I'm certainly open to. I haven't booked any baseball gigs yet, but I'm ready.
Now, you brought a prototype of the new album here, right? What do we have?
That's right. The CD actually is being printed by Super Duper here in Madison, and they are going to have it to me in my hand by Friday. And I got confirmation of that today. So I'm so excited. Friday, I wanted to get it done before the playoffs. I didn't want it to be like a, ha-ha, we beat everybody and we're the winners. I also didn't want to, if something happened, I didn't want to have to like shelf this and not do it. I thought, I'm doing this before. So it is going to come out during the regular season. And it's sort of a soundtrack to the playoffs.
So do you have a next Brewers project in mind? I don't want to, or maybe would you branch out to the Packers, or this is like a once in a lifetime kind of thing?
Well, I think this is niche, mm-hmm. and I think, making an entire country album about the Brewers is somewhat niche because you have to find the Brewers fans who are country music fans as well. But it's a slice of me. And so I hope that I'm doing this because right now, it's easy to get bogged down, to get stressed, to feel anxiety, and to read the news and just withdraw and become reclusive. And this was my way of celebrating what brings me joy. And so it's an insight, I think, into my life. I love country music. I love the Brewers. And I don't see myself necessarily doing another one because I also, I love root beer. So maybe the next thing I do is a concept album about different root beers. But I also just love writing songs about records. And I love performing with the Stardazers. And yeah, so I don't know what's next. But this was a fun sort of insight into my joy.
Nate, congratulations on the album, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. I really appreciate it.
That was Nate Gibson, archivist and musician based in Madison. I talked to him last week about his brand new country album, Fear the Beer, a musical salute to the Milwaukee Brewers, going out on another one of those songs called Road to the World Series.
Coming up, we travel to a summer camp in Plymouth where foster children are reunited with their biological siblings.
As I say to all my counselors, and I call them family here, this is my home away from home.
The impact of the camp Belong Wisconsin, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. At any given time in Wisconsin, 7,000 children are in foster care. Organizations estimate between 50 and 80% of siblings who enter the system are separated.
Some live close together and some don't. Some siblings are separated temporarily, some permanently.
Nestled in the rolling hills of eastern Wisconsin, a summer camp in Plymouth is where a reunification week happens for dozens of Wisconsin foster youth and their biological siblings.
Producer Mackenzie Crummy and I visited on the last day of camp as siblings prepared to say goodbye. And just a note for the children's privacy and protection, we're using first initials only.
Ready? Yeah. Happy llama, sad llama, totally bad llama.
The camp is called Belong Wisconsin, and it started 10 years ago. Each summer, foster youth and their biological siblings from all around the state meet at Camp Anakiji. It's a 450-acre, century-old camp set on Little Elkhart Lake. The siblings sleep in cabins with wooden bunk beds and no running water. Each day brings a set of activities like horseback riding, tie-dyeing, and, of course, roasting marshmallows around a giant campfire. The siblings make pillows for each other with personal messages, and they even pick sibling constellations so when they are at home and separated, they can stare up at the sky and know they are looking at the same stars. This year, there are 42 campers, including a sibling pair we met, the eldest of the sisters we're calling S.
Well, my sister knows. She talks to everyone, so.
S is in high school, and this is her second year at the camp. Last year, her and her sister used to bicker, but now they get along.
We do have moments together because, for example, we have the bunk beds, but she doesn't sleep on the top bunk where she's supposed to. She sleeps in my bed. So we have those moments. Yeah, those are the moments we spend together.
She wants to be closer to you.
Yeah, for sure.
That must feel good.
Sometimes. We're so close in age. We're like, why are you still sleeping in my bed? Like, go to your own bed. But I enjoy it because I know she loves me. It's just all out of love. But yeah, I love her.
Serenaded by the cicadas, this week is therapeutic, fun, and memorable. But at the end of camp, they have to say goodbye. As S and I sit under a canopy of trees talking about foster care and family separation, she turns the interview around and asks me,
would you come here with your sibling?
You know what? I don't have a sibling.
Would you come here if you had a sibling or anyone?
I would. It's so peaceful, and it's just, it feels like removed from all of the other worries of life.
Yeah. Why did you come here today?
Because we're telling a story about this camp. Just about helping people maybe understand a little bit more about child separation, about siblings who can't be together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because not, you know, people may not understand what that's like. Are there any words that you can speak to what it is like that could help someone who is not in the situation understand better?
It's like you're missing one of your kidneys. Like, you have two kidneys, but, like, you're missing one, and you can live without the one, but it just feels odd. It feels strange. It hurts. Like, it physically and emotionally, like, hurts.
This camp is run by volunteers.
All right. You guys can come with us, and I'll get you hooked up with some kids over here.
That is Belong Wisconsin's executive director, Echelon Mayer. She's training 30 volunteers who serve as a kind of support system for the kids as they move through activities and bond with their siblings. Mayer has been a part of the camp since the start. Her parents helped launch this in 2015. Oh, and all the counselors have a camp nickname.
I'm Echelon, or Dr. Fresh. So nice to meet you as well.
That's her name at the camp, Dr. Fresh.
Yeah. If you say Echelon, the kids would be like, who are you talking about?
Mayer knows every inch of the camp's winding wooden trails that are dotted with rustic cabins. She still recalls the first time she was a counselor.
I hated it. It was so hard. And the whole week, I was like, oh, I'm glad I'm here. But, like, man, I can't wait to go home to my bed and my house and my cat and my family. And as I was running through the list of all the things I was excited to go home to, I realized that this is that home for these kids, because they're not going back home. They're going back somewhere else. And they're going to be separated. And I knew that I was going to do this forever and that I would check my privilege.
Like the children's relationships, funding for this camp is fragile and complex. The Belong Wisconsin organization was previously associated with an international group called Camp to Belong. When that organization was acquired last year, Mayer and her fellow camp leaders thought it was the right time to break away and become an independent nonprofit. But building a nonprofit takes time and money. Belong Wisconsin partnered with the State Department of Children and Families, but they didn't think funding would come through in time. Mayer anticipated having to take a year or two off from the camp.
We came to camp last year with the idea that this was our last closing campfire, that this was the end for a while. And before dinner on that night, and I'm going to cry for this, before dinner, they came back to us and they were like, we'll fund you. And I got to tell my whole team that we got to be back, and it was wild. And so then on like September 2nd, we hit the ground running and we built a brand new nonprofit in like 2 months. So yeah, I'm gonna need a minute. I've been holding that in, I think, the entire year, to find out that we were gonna get the funding and then to know how much work we had to do. Because we had to build the nonprofit and have everything functioning, because camp planning starts in December of the previous year. It takes a whole year to make this happen. And so we had to move so fast. And I have honestly been just waiting for this week to be over to really process what we've accomplished in a year. Yeah.
That's huge.
It is. It's.
And so you are fairly certain you won't have to take a gap year again. You feel established enough to say, yes, there will be camp next year? Or
yes and no. We do not have secure funding at this point at all. We have no idea how we're funding next year.
The true cost of camp is around $2,000 per camper. They charge $500 if families can afford it. If not, they can come for free. Mayer says Belong Wisconsin will not turn away a child because of cost. They gather donations and counselors work for free. Everyone is determined to keep it going. Research shows keeping biological siblings together in foster care is beneficial,
And in Wisconsin, the law requires state agencies to make reasonable efforts to place siblings together. But it's not always possible due to a shortage of foster families and in cases where there are larger sibling groups. Mayer sought out researchers to help assess the positive impact of this camp on the kids' well-being.
We have for many years worked with the School of Social Work through Minnesota University and did a multi-year study on the sibling relationship and resiliency. And we have found that sibling camp absolutely improves the resiliency and connection for these siblings. We did find that the largest jump in that resiliency and connection does happen in that first year of camp, but does continue to maintain throughout the year. But on a non, you know, empirical study kind of way, the information that I have comes directly from the campers.
How was your ride, hon?
Good.
You remember how to get down from yesterday? All right, and then your helmet goes in that big black bin that says used helmets, okay?
Years ago, one sibling pair went to camp, and they weren't particularly close. One child was in foster care, the other wasn't. One was the youngest of the family, the other a few years older. But over time at Belong Wisconsin, their relationship grew. They became closer, and now they are both camp counselors.
My first name is Chelsea Gilbert, and I also go by Hershey here at camp.
So I am Pickles in camp, and outside of camp, I am Anthony, A-N-T-H-O-N-Y. Last name is Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T.
Hershey and Pickles return each year. Counselors are required to go through trauma-informed training. They learn de-escalation and redirection techniques to ensure campers have all the support they need, even when navigating sibling conflicts.
When you hear and see these kids and their stories, I know what that's like. You know, me and Hershey, my sister, we started out this camp together as campers. So we've been in that spot. We know what that's like.
Pickles is decked out in brightly colored bandanas, head to toe. He calls it his camp spirit and says the bandanas hold all of his memories of years past. Although he's been coming to camp since its inception, he is one bandana short.
Sorry, I'm gonna get emotional right now, but I had 11, because 11 years is how long I've been here, but one of the years, I had a kid ask me at the very end of camp when they went home, they're like, I want something to remember you by, can I have this bandana? And they chose the specific one that they want, and I just started tearing up. I'm like, of course, I'm gonna give you that. I want you to have that. So it's, camp really has an impact on you, whether you're a counselor, a camper, admin, whatever your role is here. It's a good thing, though.
Hershey and Pickles check in on each other throughout the camp, making sure each other is doing okay. They go on the water together when they can, eat next to each other at mealtime. Their relationship has grown stronger each year. Here's Hershey.
I get to spend it with my own sibling. We have older siblings, too, but I'm the baby of the family, so knowing that I get to have Pickles here with me makes it a lot more easier. It's rough sometimes, but to know at the end that we are doing this for the children and to see their smiles on their face just is that warming heart sensation, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Let me get it. I know how, I can do it. Watch. Here, let me see. Oh my God, that's, I got you, I'm gonna switch.
We are nearing the end of our visit. The campers will be leaving in the morning. Mayer radios into her walkie-talkie, asking a staffer to go buy tissues. She knows the tears will come, and she wants each camper to have their own tissue packet.
These kids know that they're going home tomorrow. The tears started last night at the dance party. For some of these kids, this is the time that they get to be with their siblings in a place where it's not school, it's not a courtroom, it's not a visit with supervision. They just get to be kids together. And so it's a really magical place for them, but we do have to acknowledge that it's kind of like Disney. It's not real. This isn't every day, and they're not going to get this again.
Oh, that is 100% legal.
All right, 10-9.
That is legal.
But before we go, let's circle back to high schooler S again. Remember, she's the one who said not having your sibling is like living without a kidney. You can do it, but it doesn't feel right. She dreams of becoming a politician, and when she gets elected, she doesn't mince words about what laws she would change.
Every last one of them, they all suck. We gotta fix them.
But mostly, S would focus on laws related to foster youth. She says not all foster parents have the emotional intelligence to bring children into their homes, and that it's not about what the house looks like or the bedroom setup. It's about understanding their needs and caring deeply.
And also, I would be like, hey, you guys need to put them in the camp. You know that they're okay and you hope that they're okay, but when you come to this camp and you see that they're okay and that they're having fun at where they're at, you just, and especially as an older sibling, you just feel like happy for them and happy that, I guess foster care is a poopy system, but it's also like a system where it can be good. People are good. Like, they're not all evil or bad.
We also want to give a special shout out to some of the other people we talked with at the camp, like Counselor Braveheart.
As I say to all my counselors, and I call them family here, this is my home away from home.
And a middle schooler who has been coming to camp for 2 years and likes to try out paddleboarding. Do you play a sport? What sport?
Volleyball.
You're a volleyball player? Wow, that's so cool. What do you love about volleyball?
I don't know, smacking balls.
And G, who is also a middle schooler, discovered his brother loves to dance.
He never really dances like in public, so he knows that like, oh, no one's gonna make fun of him. So now he's just saying like, oh yeah, I can actually do this stuff. No one's gonna be like mad or like laugh at me.
Belong Wisconsin is hosting more special events for siblings this fall, like sailing in Milwaukee and a 10-year anniversary celebration of the camp.
Warp speed! Happy Lama's head, I'm a totally rad, I'm a super Lama, I'm a big rad, I'm a loose.
And we leave you now back at the campfire for the Lama song as the siblings make another memory together.
Me and Dr. Coconut, she's into a palm tree.
Thanks to producer Mackenzie Crummy, photojournalist Angela Major, and to Sarah Hopeful for sound design. You can learn more about Belong Wisconsin at its website. Coming up, it's Bat Month. We'll look at efforts to protect Wisconsin's 8 bat species.
Bats are important, right? They're amazing animals and fascinating to us, but they do benefit us, particularly our farmers and foresters, and just us out enjoying our backyard.
That's next here on WPR News.
You're with us on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about getting up close and a bit personal with bats.
The Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin offers hundreds of field trips each year that bring members face-to-face with some of the state's natural wonders. WPR's Beatrice Lawrence went along on a trip to Nelson Dewey State Park along the Mississippi River to witness a swarm of 3,000 bats put on a show as they returned to their homes at dawn.
It's 4 a.m. and dark. Paul White greets about 20 people. He's the bat program lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation.
Must be a lot of birders here. You guys are ready to go.
Yeah. The group finds their seats and waits quietly for the show to start. As the sun slowly rises, we begin to see the bats dancing. This field trip to Nelson Dewey State Park was organized by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit that works to protect the state's lands, waters, and wildlife. This weekend, the group is camping to see the Stonefield colony of bats as they emerge to feed at sunset. They'll also witness the bats return as a swarm at dawn. all 3,000 of them.
So it's the beauty of Morning Swarm that we really want to be able to show people, and that's why this field trip is special.
That's Jennifer Riddell, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. She says she enjoys giving people the opportunity to get up close and personal with an animal that's often misunderstood or unnoticed.
But it's one of the most beautiful and like mysterious wildlife phenomena that happen every morning in the summer, you know, outside every major bat roost across the state, and people don't know about it. And it's this really cool way to experience bats up close.
Each year, the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin organizes hundreds of these trips to get people in touch with the natural world and show them conservation projects in action. Riddell says this trip is especially powerful, and that people might even come out the other side as bat lovers.
Because nobody wants to get up at 4 a.m.
Multiple times.
Right. To watch bats. Until you've seen Swarm, and then you're like addicted. Like, oh, I've got to go see that again.
This expedition is full of field trip veterans, like Henry Nels Lowe of Fitchburg.
They are amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah, they are. All of them are fabulous. You know, I've got a monarch tagging coming up. Hummingbird tagging is coming up. I've just seen so many remarkable things, gone out just learning about different places I've never been.
Against the sunrise, thousands of little brown bats fly around our heads. There's so many, it's a wonder they don't hit each other or us. The DNR's Paul White prepared us for this moment.
Just close your mouth.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the bat kiss.
Wow.
Yeah.
Last night, the bats left their homes and flew away immediately to eat. But this morning, the bats take their time returning to their boxes. The swarm grows as they dance around each other, occasionally squabbling or flying smack into the side of the boxes. As the bats finally make their way back into their boxes, it falls silent. People like Alex Ellman of Appleton are in awe.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it was crazy when you started to realize how many bats were underneath the houses swarming. Because it's like there were so many, and it was almost like they would come at you and then split, kind of like the Red Sea, and then circle around. And then all of a sudden, as it got a little bit lighter, I was like, oh my God, there's like so many bats. Like, so many bats. It was so cool.
The bats are finally settled in for the morning.
They're probably wondering where the nearest coffee shop is.
And the humans, we have the whole day ahead of us. Coffee will help, but seeing the bats' morning swarm, no amount of caffeine can energize you like that.
WPR's Beatrice Lawrence brought us that story on bat viewing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell & Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
It's October, which means it is the season of pumpkins and candy, cobwebs, and bats. International Bat Week is later this month, ending on Halloween, and the State Department of Natural Resources has events planned statewide to celebrate.
Wisconsin is home to 8 species of bats. 4 of those are considered threatened species. That decline is mostly due to white nose syndrome, a fungal infection that's decimated populations of hibernating bats.
But last year, some populations in Wisconsin began to show signs of recovery.
2 conservation biologists with the Wisconsin Bat Program join us now for an update on Wisconsin's bat population and conservation efforts. J. Paul White is the Bat Program lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation, and Jennifer Riddell is a conservation biologist and cave and mine specialist with the state DNR. Jennifer, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, let's start with you. October kicks off. What are our bats in Wisconsin doing at this time of year?
Sure. They're migrating either to hibernation sites or they're migrating out of the state entirely. And in many cases, you can find them all along the way. In fact, I stopped by the building here and found one right on the roosting above the doorway.
And Jennifer, we've got multiple bat species, and you were with us about a year ago to talk about white nose syndrome, which people may have heard about. Is this a threat to all bat species in Wisconsin, or those cave dwellers in particular?
No, it's a disease of hibernating bats, mm-hmm. and that's because the fungus that causes this disease is a cold-loving fungus, so it only grows in the cool conditions underground on a bat's body that's cold when it's hibernating.
Now, when we last talked to you, this has been, it seemed like nothing but bad news about white nose. There were maybe some positive signs for at least one species. What have we seen over the last year?
Well, over the last several years, actually, we've been getting some good news in Wisconsin, and it looks like our bats may be on a path to recovery. Maybe I wouldn't say a road to recovery, mm-hmm. but our little brown
path.
Right. Our little brown bats and big brown bats have been doing quite well. Big browns mostly unaffected, and little browns, the numbers have been going up.
Now, I want to zoom in on little brown bats. I'm kind of familiar with bats. I've talked about them on the show over the years. I didn't realize what a big deal Wisconsin is for. I think it's the little brown bats. They're really concentrated here, right, Jennifer?
Yeah, we have a significant proportion of the little brown bats in the United States hibernating each winter in Wisconsin at just a very few sites, and those are mines.
Paul, some changes have come along in DNR rules about wind turbines. People may have heard about birds and bats having trouble. What kind of changes have there been, and how might they affect our bat population?
Sure. The broad incidental take permit is for wind energy, and the idea is that we recognize that wind is an important energy resource, but we also realize that, unfortunately, turbines can detrimentally affect bats. And so we had put conservation measures in place primarily along or in these areas that bats congregate, whether it's a hibernation site in the winter or a summer maternity colony where they aggregate. And so in those areas, we have specific regulations where they actually have to abide by. There are certain cut-in speeds where the wind turbine will start to spin, and we increase those depending on how far they are away from these particular bat priority areas.
And Paul, wind turbines, just one part of the problem, white nose, as Jennifer was saying. Are there other things when it comes to habitat loss or climate change, other things that we are worried about when it comes to their impact on bats in the state?
Both of those, yeah. Yep, habitat loss, climate change, certainly as bats might move, northern in climates. And so we also see that, bats can be evicted during the wrong time of year. And so bats will often find their way into attics, barns, and that type of thing. And if people do not exclude them or evict them during the right times of the year, they can leave vulnerable pups inside and unfortunately separate them from their mothers.
Well, I was going to get into that later. I want to talk to you about, I've had that house with bats in it a couple of houses ago. And there's always the question, how do I deal with them humanely in a way that, this is a threatened species that doesn't harm them? What do you tell people, Jennifer, who are in that situation?
Yeah, well, no one should have to share their actual living space with bats, right? We do have to be concerned about rabies, mm-hmm. which is in very few bats, but it's a very serious concern.
Yeah.
So to humanely evict bats, we want people to put up one-way doors between August 15th and June 1st of the following year. And that's the period when bats are not using the roost and they're away from that site. And then similarly, if you do find a bat in the living space, if it's just flying around and you've encountered it, you can open a door or window, leave the lights on. We don't want to see that bat get lost under a painting or a couch or something, but it will eventually tire and land if it doesn't fly out on its own. And then you can put a shoebox or a bucket over the top and slide some cardboard underneath and get it put safely outside.
I got to be pretty good at that and wear your gloves too, right?
Correct.
And that critical period though, Paul, the bat breeding period, that month that is excluded, why is that so important?
Well, so June 1st is effectively what we call bat birthday. And so that's when many of the pups are born in Wisconsin. And so at that point, they're very reliant on their mother. 3 to 4 weeks, they cannot fly. And so they're heavily reliant on their mother. They cannot fly. And so as the mothers are leaving, these pups are staying put and they're using their big feet to stay in one place and hold on for dear life until their mothers come back. And so if you evict during that June and July period, you run the risk of allowing the mothers to leave and not come back in. And so that's where it separates and you'll eventually, unfortunately, you might end up killing half the colony.
Now, Jennifer, tell us about the role of volunteers in as monitors for the well-being of our bat species, especially those cave bat species.
Yeah, we really rely on the data that volunteers collect and submit because Paul and our colleague Heather and myself can't be out across Wisconsin every night at every bat roost. So there are volunteers who count bats as they drop and fly away from the roost at night. So whether that's a bat house or an attic or a barn, they submit the data, or they're out using a bat. We call it a detector to record echolocation calls, and each echolocation call is unique to each species. And then we can take all that data in and look at what's happening statewide and kind of keep our finger on the pulse of bat health.
Something I'm curious about, Jennifer, bats are often in old mines. And actually, I was looking at a presentation you did a while back, and you mentioned, well, they must have been somewhere before humans started building mines. What were bats doing before they had these abandoned human-created mines for their hibernation space?
Right. It's kind of a big mystery. And,
really?
You know, yeah, we certainly have a number of caves, but our caves are small. They typically have one entrance, and they're relatively warm compared to the mines that are usually more spacious and complex. And of course, they're relics of industry, and they were places where people needed to be safe. So there's multiple entrances. And that means today, more airflow and perhaps a wider variety of temperatures for bats. So it seems that once mines were opened up on the landscape, and then of course later shut down and abandoned, even though people never intended these to be great bat sites, bats are amazingly adaptable at utilizing our human structures, whether it's, you know, the bat in the attic or the bat in the mine. And they've come in and probably survived in greater numbers because of those good hibernating conditions.
Paul, I know people have put bat boxes up, at least for some species. What kind of difference does that make for bats and their well-being?
It can help tremendously, primarily for little browns and big brown bats. It allows them to keep warm in a safe environment away from predators and in the elements, and it allows them to raise their pups so that they can go out and eat a bunch of insects. So yeah, it's a great way, and it's actually a really easy way for us to then monitor them. And if we have some sort of treatment that we're looking for white nose syndrome, we can look at those areas because that's exactly, you know, they're concentrated in these areas. So
as we head through the fall and then into the winter, Jennifer, what are the big questions for you as you're watching our bat populations, especially those hibernators?
Yeah, well, we're always curious to see what we're going to find. We go out and survey approximately 50 hibernation sites each year. Again, most are concentrated, you know, in the old mining areas and also the Driftless area where we have natural caves. So the southwest corner of the state. But also
sort of along, lead mining area, places like that.
Right, and also along the Niagara Escarpment and up into Door County, as well as Pierce County, where we have former frac sand mines. And we're always anxious when we go in to, you know, see, has the population continued to grow these last few years? And that makes us feel pretty hopeful when it has. But I have to say that not every species has been impacted the same way. The news is very mixed, so when we go into most of the small sites, the caves and smaller mines, we're not seeing stabilization or recovery in many of those sites. They are still missing most of their bats.
Paul, what do you wish people knew more about bats?
Well, I mean, they're mysterious, they're gentle, we need them, and they need us. And so besides the fact that they eat so many different agricultural pests, forestry pests, and human pests, it's just amazing to be able to marvel at them at night now more than ever.
International Bat Week is coming up. What do bat people do to celebrate, Jennifer?
Well, it's a time to celebrate the importance of bats in the environment. You know, people are so fascinated by them. We want folks to go out and learn about them. And there are events happening all across the state of Wisconsin throughout the month of October. We turn it into Bat Month, not just Bat Week, even though Bat Week is at the end of October. So if you visit batweek.org, you can find events near you. And when you learn something, hopefully it's going to be how to help bats. And then we hope you'll be inspired to go out and do that.
Now we'll leave it there. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
J. Paul White is Bat Program Lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. Jennifer Riddell is a conservation biologist and cave and mine specialist with the DNR. They join us for an update on Wisconsin's bat population and conservation efforts. By the way, we've got a video up on our Instagram and YouTube feeds with some visual aids from Jennifer and Paul and a bat that made a stopover on the outside of Vilas Hall, where we host this show from. The weekend might be a good time to settle in with a book or dig into that stack on your nightstand, and we're wondering, what are your favorite reads, especially by Wisconsin authors?
Is there a particular genre you like the best, or is there a book you picked up recently that surprised you?
Tell us about your favorite reads. We're always up for book recommendations. We'd love to share what's on your reading list.
And while you're at it, give a shout out to a book group.
Send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can text us or send us a voicemail to talk about great books in your life. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
And thanks for sharing your story about a love of reading.
Wisconsin Weekend is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.